The climax of the book of Exodus here today. We're going to be looking at the Red Sea crossing, which shows up in Exodus chapter 14. Kind of a lengthy chapter. Well, we're going to hit it all today. I'm going to read the passage. We'll have a word of prayer, and then we'll look at it. Exodus chapter 14, it says, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, that they turn and encamp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, over against Baal-Ziphon. Before it shall ye encamp by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, They are entangled in the land, and the wilderness hath shut them in. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he shall follow after them. And I will be honored upon Pharaoh and upon all his host, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. And it was told the king of Egypt that the people fled. And the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, Why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us? And he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. And he took 600 chosen chariots and all the chariots of Egypt and captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued after the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out with an high hand. And the Egyptians pursued after him, and all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them encamping by the sea, beside Pi-Hahiroth, before Baal-Ziphon. And when Pharaoh drew nigh, and the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, they were sore afraid. And the children of Israel cried out unto Moses, And they said to Moses, Because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore hast thou dealt thus with us, to carry us forth out of Egypt? Is not this the word that we did tell thee in Egypt, saying, Let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. And Moses said unto the people, Fear ye not. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show you this day. For the Egyptians whom you see this day, ye shall see them again no more forever. And the Lord shall fight for you, and ye shall hold your peace. And the Lord said unto Moses, Wherefore criest thou unto me? Speak unto the children of Israel, that they go forward. But lift thou up thy rod, and stretch out thine hand over the sea, and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. And I will get my honor upon Pharaoh and upon all his host, upon his chariots and upon his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gotten me honor upon Pharaoh, upon his chariots and upon his horsemen. And the angel of the Lord, which went before the camp of Israel, removed and went behind them. And the pillar of the cloud went from before their face and stood behind them. And it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel, and it was a cloud and darkness to them, but it gave light by night to these, so that the one came not near the other all the night. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the children of Israel went up into the midst of the sea upon the dry ground, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued, and went in after them in the midst of the sea, even all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And it came to pass that in the morning watch the Lord looked into the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and the cloud, and troubled the host of the Egyptians, and took off the chariot wheels, that they drave them heavily, so that the Egyptians said, Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fighteth for them against the Egyptians. And the Lord said unto Moses, Stretch out thine hand over the sea, that the waters may come again upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and upon their horsemen. And Moses stretched forth his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to his strength when the morning appeared. And the Egyptians fled against it, and the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. And the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. There remained not so much as one of them. And the children of Israel walked upon dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. And Israel saw that great work which the Lord did upon the Egyptians. And the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. Let's have a word of prayer this morning. Lord, we do thank you for the deliverance that you offer to your people, the redemption from their land of bondage. You've done that for the Israel out of Egypt, and you've done it for believers here today. You are a mighty God, and it's with a strong hand that you do deliver. We thank you for it. It's in your name we pray. Amen. So as I say, this is the climax of the book of Exodus. And by the way, this is the last we are going to see of Pharaoh's oppression. So far in the book, it's been Pharaoh versus God through Moses. And here Pharaoh is crushingly defeated. This is the end of the duel of Yahweh versus Pharaoh. Now, one thing that I ought to call to your attention, you're aware of it, but I'm going to remind you of it. We've seen a lot of pharaohs in the Bible up till now. Throughout the book of Genesis, we've seen two pharaohs so far in the book of Exodus. We are not going to see another pharaoh mentioned until 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 16, when Solomon marries Pharaoh's daughter. That's the next time any pharaoh ever gets mentioned. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of years. About 500 years. That's a long period of time to not mention a guy, a king of a large nation. But this is more than a story about the mortality of Pharaoh. This is another revelation of the character of God. Verse 4 tells us that this happens, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. That's what God says. This is why I am doing this. And down at the bottom of the chapter, it says, and Israel saw the great work which the Lord did upon the Egyptians, and the people feared the Lord. So this was so that Pharaoh would realize who the Lord was, although it's too late for him. And it's so that Israel would know who the Lord is as well. God is revealing himself. This is the most powerful revelation that God will deliver until the resurrection of Christ. This is the one that Orthodox Jews still look to this day, 4,000 years later. As I say, it wasn't just for the Egyptians to see the power of God. Next week, we're going to see a poetic expression that this event reveals that this was a powerful revelation of God. That's what the Song of Moses is all about. Is I have seen God, my strength, my salvation. That's what Moses is going to sing about. That's what we'll look at next time. But by delivering his people in this way, God is demonstrating not simply his power, but his nature as well. We're seeing something of God's nature. This is one of the mightiest acts God will do for the nation of Israel, and it will shape the nation from this point on. This is what makes Israel the nation that they are, this act right here. These people and their descendants will remember this forever. As I say, Orthodox Jews still look to the Red Sea crossing as the definitive redemption of their nation. And you see it throughout the Old Testament as you read. I'll give you a list of some, when I'm not going to look at them right now, I'll give you some really high points, by no means all of them. But look at Psalm 78:13, Psalm 136, verses 10 to 15, Isaiah 51, verse 50, Isaiah 63, pretty much the whole chapter, particularly the teens, 12 and 14 particularly come to mind. Those are just a few really high points where God refers back to the Red Sea crossing. it's throughout the Psalms. So with that, all that for an introduction, let's kind of look at our study here. The first part of the chapter really gives us the setting for this Red Sea crossing. It says that they encamped before Pi-Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea over against Baal-Zephon. Well, nobody knows exactly where any of these locations are. And this is what leads to some debate as to where the crossing actually took place. If you look on the map in the back of your Bible, the Red Sea is a long, skinny body of water. And up toward the top, there are a couple of skinny legs on it, kind of. This crossing apparently happened in a relatively short period of time. So I assume that it happened up in one of these more narrow sections of the Red Sea. That's an assumption on my part. There is some debate. We can notice many things from the text itself. The nation was on their way to the Sinai wilderness when verse 2 says that God told them to make a turn. Speak unto the children of Israel that they turn and encamp before Pi-Hahiroth. When they turn, that means they were headed one way, they turned another way. They turned to encamp before Pi-Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea over against Baal-Zephon. Before it you shall encamp by the sea. So they make a turn. And it says that they headed toward the sea. I don't know if you bothered to count how many times it says sea, 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 sea throughout this chapter. It tells me that this was not some swampy location like some commentators will say. God is clearly making a point that this was a sea, a large, massive body of water. It says it over and over and over and over again throughout this chapter. There's a huge difference between a sea and a swamp. I hope you realize that. But in any case, the reason for God's action here is very clear. He wants to set up a situation where Pharaoh feels like he might be able to recoup his losses. God is setting Pharaoh up here. God is going to show his supremacy before Pharaoh one more time in a very clear way. So either Pharaoh will win by snatching the Israelites out of God's hand, or God will break Pharaoh's hands. Now you could ask me, why do I use the word hand? Why do I use the word hand twice there in that little sentence? Well, God did it first. God uses the word hand 9 times in this chapter to describe, I am going to snatch them out of Pharaoh's hand. He says it in verse 8, 16, 21, 22, 26, 27, 29, 30, and 31. God says hand, 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 hand. I am breaking Pharaoh's hands here. Pharaoh will not be able to do anything anymore. God makes it very clear he delivers them out of the hand of the Egyptians. And that's how verse 4 is fulfilled. Verse 4 says, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he shall follow after them, and I will be honored upon Pharaoh and all upon all his host, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. God is looking for honor, don't you see? I am going to be honored. Now, that Hebrew word that's translated honored here means heaviness. It means significance, weightiness. So what this really means is that this final defeat of Pharaoh shows how significant God really and truly is. The significance of God and the insignificance of Pharaoh. You see, Yahweh is making it clear that he is more than simply a tribal deity. He is a God that can defeat the most powerful nation on earth by using the very sea as his tool. I'll give you a little bit of a look into what we're going to talk about next week. We're going to be talking about Moses' song the Song of Moses after the deliverance in the Red Sea, and he mentions chaos. He mentions the sea as chaos. And you'll see, if you read through the book of Psalms, you'll see this term referred to over and over and over and over again in the book of Psalms. It's Rahab. Not talking about Rahab the harlot. It's spelled exactly the same way. Rahab. That's a Middle Eastern god of chaos. The sea was where Rahab lived. It was Leviathan is the same word. What we see in the as Leviathan in the book of Job. This is the god of chaos. God, Yahweh, can use the god of chaos to bring order and his honor. Do you see? That's what Moses will be singing about next week. So that's a little look at, that's a teaser for next week. But back to this. God is using that god of chaos as his tool. To the Egyptians, the sea was chaos. God shows that it is not chaos, but that he is the creator and he is the sustainer and is in total control of the sea. The Egyptians look at the sea, they see chaos. God looks at the sea and sees a tool. God's showing that this duel is more than just a power struggle between he and Pharaoh. You see, Pharaoh had imprisoned these people against their will. And he has even gone so far as to use genocide to keep them imprisoned. Remember that at the beginning of the book. He was killing all the Hebrew male children. But now they have escaped him. They've escaped Pharaoh. And now he wants to use his military might to try to recapture them. So what's going on here is really a conflict between human wickedness and God's moral law. Do you see that? A man that will stoop to using genocide to enslave people, God's moral law is going to overshadow that. God will get the glory when his law triumphs over wickedness. But verse 5 is an interesting look. Let's read verse 5. It says, "And it was told the king of Egypt that the people fled. And the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, 'Why have we done this? That we have let Israel go from serving us.'" It's an interesting look at the subtle ways that might motivate mankind. Why did Pharaoh pursue the Israelites? Now, if you look at verses 4 and you look at verse 8, you might think God forced Pharaoh by simply hardening his heart again. Wow, I'm going to go down there, I'm going to harden his heart, and he's going to chase after you. If you read verses 4 and 8 by themselves out of context, That could be the conclusion you might come to. But verse 5 says that Pharaoh was going to pursue them anyway for his own reasons. The Egyptians all looked around and said, "What have we done? What have we done?" You see, Pharaoh has kind of a morning after change of mind, you see. He made a decision in a passion. I can't blame him. I'm going to step into Pharaoh's shoes here. "I have just watched my firstborn slain. I have watched the firstborn throughout my nation slain. You people get out of here. Leave this land. I don't ever want to see you people again." If I were in Pharaoh's shoes, I would have made the same decision. I would have done exactly what he did. He was in a passion in the middle of the night. The screams were heard throughout the land of Egypt of the firstborn dying and the people discovering them dead. I would have done exactly what Pharaoh would have done, what Pharaoh did. But then after a couple of days of consideration, he says, "Wait a minute. What have I done? What have I done?" He regrets the decision and takes a different course of action. Now, many commentators, myself included, I'm making a commentary right now, so I can include myself as a commentator. That is what I am doing right now. I'm doing a verbal commentary. I'm not writing it down. So many commentators, and myself included, believe that this decision actually took 3 days to make. Now, I can make the case for that. The text doesn't really come right out and say that, but I can make the case based on the locations where it says, God says, "And they stopped and camped here, and they stopped and camped here." We see exactly three encampments before this. I'm going to say it took 3 days. The text doesn't actually come out and say that. But in any case, that's really here, neither here nor there. The fact is, Pharaoh now regrets his earlier decision. He's lost a huge part of his nation's workforce. And he says to himself, what have I done? What have I done? You see, Pharaoh was driven by basically three things. He was driven by a lust for comfort. It's no longer comfortable. Now I'm going to have to make my own people work. He's got a lust for power. He doesn't dominate this people group anymore. And you could say, lust for domination, what's the difference? You're splitting hairs here. Domination, power. He's driven by a drive for domination. It's true that God did harden Pharaoh's heart. The text says so. But this decision was one that he came to entirely on his own. He was going to do this. God hardened him further. Jim. You could speculate for a long time. I think probably all of those factors play into it. Human beings are. We get a lot of passions and a lot of emotions that'll play and help us make irrational decisions. Making a decision based on your emotional feelings at the time will almost always lead you in the wrong direction. If you make a decision based on your emotions, you will almost always be wrong. And I can make that argument from the Bible pretty easily. I don't really have time to get into that right now. But I think you're right. I think all of these things were working on him. They were eating on him for several days. But notice another thing. When you look at verses 10 and 12, 10 to the 12, let's read that again. And when Pharaoh drew nigh, and the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. And the children of Israel cried out unto the Lord. And they said unto Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore hast thou dealt thus with us, to carry us forth out of Egypt? Is not this the word that we did tell thee in Egypt, saying, let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? For it had been better that we serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. You see, the Israelites have a mourning after experience as well. They look at the Red Sea in front of them. They look at the Egyptians behind them and they say, what have we done? What have we done? They barely had time to enjoy their newfound freedom. I'll put it out for consideration because I'm teaching this class that it's been about 3 days. 3 days. They've had a little bit of freedom for 3 days. And now they're faced with an army on one side and the Red Sea on the other. And so they start to hesitate here. And they get very sarcastic with Moses when they refer to the graves of Egypt. Now think with me for just a moment. What is one of the things that Egypt is most famous for? Mummies. Embalming the graves. Egypt is known for its graves. The graves of the pharaohs. They just dug up another one last week, by the way. They found another pharaoh's grave. If there's one thing that Egypt is known for, it is their graves. So the Israelite people, and many of that was built by slave labor, the Israelites probably built most of those graves that we're still discovering today. They're being very snarky in their language here. Moses, wasn't there enough graves in Egypt? Is it because there weren't any graves in Egypt that you took us out here to die in the wilderness? You see the sarcasm that they're putting out to them? We built those graves, Moses. We could at least die in them. Now, psychologists have observed this sort of phenomenon going on in long-term prisoners, people who have been in prison for a long, long time. These people have been in prison for 430 years. Long-term prisoners who are suddenly released and have not yet had time to take responsibility for their actions or to work on their own initiative, the first time that they get an obstacle in front of them, a rational obstacle that will require them to think their way through it, they go into a panic and they become cynical and they become very depressed. It happens almost universally with long-term prisoners. But still, haven't these people learned anything about the power of God? They've just watched God unleash 9 plagues and then the death of the firstborn. Haven't they learned anything? Haven't they yet learned to trust God? Now, we're going to see this same issue show up time and time again throughout the book of Exodus. As they wander through the wilderness, we're going to see it over and over. I mean, they're going to cross the Red Sea, and then just a couple of days later, we're going to see them, Moses, why did you lead us out here to die of thirst? Why did you lead us out here to starve to death? Every couple of days, they're giving Moses trouble for 40 years. Every couple of days. They keep asking, are God's intentions for us really for our good? That's the essence of what they're asking. Did God really do this for our good? Why is this happening? It's just like the serpent in Eden, isn't it? Just like the serpent in Eden. They raise the question of, does God really have your best interests at heart? That's the essence of the question. Does God really have your best interest at heart? Now, we're going to see a good solid demonstration here that God can, in fact, be trusted. Whether we trust Him or not, He can be trusted. God doesn't change. My fickle emotions make me change, and my opinion of God and my trust of God changes. But God will always be trustworthy. God does not change. Now, verses 13 and 14 give us my personal favorite glimpse at Moses himself. This is my favorite snapshot of Moses. You can look at all kinds of things Moses did. You can look at him up on Sinai. You can look at him when he smashes the Ten Commandments, when he sees the people rioting. This is my favorite snapshot of Moses. I'm going to read verses 13 and 14 again. And Moses said unto the people, fear ye not, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show to you this day. For the Egyptians whom ye have seen today, ye shall see them again no more forever. The Lord shall fight for you, and ye shall hold your peace. Moses doesn't even know what God's going to do at this point. God has not revealed to Moses what he is going to do, but he knows that these Egyptians that you see right now, you're never, ever going to see them again. God is going to fight this fight, and you aren't going to have to do anything. You stand still and watch the salvation of the Lord. God, how are you going to get us out of this? That's what Moses says. He has no idea what God is going to do. God doesn't reveal that to him until just a couple of verses later. Moses doesn't know that he's going to stand up there and hold his rod out. He just tells the people, stand still and watch God work. Moses has a lot of other high points, but this one is my favorite. Even if nobody else in all of Israel had learned anything from God, Moses has. And as I say, there is no reason to think that he has any idea what God would do. But he also has no fear that God won't come through. God isn't going to break his promises now. God promised he'd deliver them. God promised that he'd bring them to the promised land. And Moses believes that he will keep his promise. He doesn't know how, but he knows God will keep his promise. And he knew that God wasn't going to be defeated now either. The Israelites were all panicking all around him. And he says, fear ye not, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord. This situation is completely out of their hands. And that's true. But it's firmly in God's hands, don't you see? When it's out of your hands, it's still in God's hands. And Moses is happy to leave it there. I'm going to leave it in God's hands, Moses says. Now that reminds me an awful lot of, you may not put this together, but I do, when Peter stepped over the side of the boat, sees Jesus walking on the Sea of Galilee, there's waves all around, it's a storm, everybody else in the boat's terrified, everybody else is in an absolute panic. Peter looks across and says, "That's Jesus! I'm coming out! I'm going to go see him. That's Moses standing right here. Everybody else is in a panic. What are we going to do? Weren't there enough graves in Egypt? Why did you bring us out here to die?" And Moses says, "Just stand still and see the salvation of the Lord." Everybody else in the boat was in a panic. And Peter says, "I'm going to go see Jesus. He's right over there. I'm going to walk to him." It's the same thing. That's faith in a true and faithful God. We like to pick on Peter's lack of faith sometimes. Peter's kind of fickle, Peter's kind of emotional. Moses is the same way. But the fact is, he was the only one who trusted enough to climb out of the boat. And Moses is the only one in the whole camp of Israel, 2 million people or more. He's the only one out of 2 million or more that really puts faith in God right here. Now, just like on Passover night, the Israelites have to endure another harrowing night. This is going to be a terrifying night. I would not have wanted to do what they are going to do right here. I would not want to have been in the... We can say, "Oh, wouldn't it be great to walk through the Red Sea?" I'm here to tell you I wouldn't want to be doing that. I wouldn't want to be doing that. The mightiest army on earth is coming down with the ultimate weapon of mass destruction that has been conceived to this day. It's a two-horse chariot. Pharaoh says that he picked his best chariots. He took 600 chosen chariots, and then he took all the other chariots of Egypt and captains over every one of them. It's a two-horse chariot. So you got two horses, you got the chariot, you got two men in the chariot. One drives the chariot, one carries a recurve bow and a lot of arrows. They carried a lot of arrows in these things. The Israelites don't have a chance against that. You're talking just in his 600 best chariots, that's 1,200 men. 1,200 men, 1,200 horses, and then it says he took other chariots and the rest of his army. We're talking a massive force. But Moses says, "Fear not, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord." That is faith, folks. Standing calm in the midst of the storms of life with no other assurance than the word of God and his promises. God said he's deliver us. I'm going to stand here and be calm. And when Moses says that, the cloud which had been leading them moves backward to stand between them and the Egyptians. Verse 19 says that this cloud was the angel of the Lord, which you and I know is an appearance of God himself. And then you see the actual crossing itself, which is pretty basic. I'm not going to go into any detail at all describing it. The Bible doesn't go into a lot of detail describing it. But the stage is set, and the players are in place. Moses raises his hand, and the waters begin to rush back upon themselves. That's what verse 21 says. Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. Again, I bring it to your attention that it calls out in that one verse three times sea, which means a large body of water, not a swamp. Moses raises his hand and the waters rush back. We see again in verse 27 that he raised his hand again and the sea closed back up on God's command. God works here again through a human agent. That's the point I want to make. In this case, Moses. Verses 16 and verses 26 tell us that Moses was acting under the command of God himself. God told him, "Raise your hand over the sea, and I will divide it." And then he says, "Raise your hand over the sea, and I will bring it back upon itself." Moses was not working without the power and the direction of God. And God does not accomplish his power and his purpose without a human to obey. That's the case I want to make here. That's been a theme throughout the book so far. We've seen that in all the plagues. God didn't act independently of Moses. God said, this is what I'm going to do. Moses, this is what you're going to do. You do it. I'll do my bit. You do your bit. We're going to do this. That's been a theme. God is the deliverer, but he uses a human tool to represent himself. I got a little bit of time left. If you'd like, I'd like to give you a free thing that I didn't pencil down here until this morning. I'm going to give you the outline to a whole different sermon you could teach on this section, a sermon on redemption, if you'd like to. I'm going to give you four different points. You can write them down. I'm going to let you fill in the body of it yourself. Four different points on redemption that we can see specifically from here and what we've seen so far in Exodus. Redemption is purely God's work. God is always the Redeemer. There is no human work that's part of redemption. Moses didn't bring the people through the Red Sea. God divided the Red Sea and brought the people through. God was the defense line between the Egyptians and the Israelites. Moses didn't build an army and defend them. God himself was it. Second point, redemption comes through a person. In this case, it's Moses. Ultimately, it was Christ. Redemption always comes through a person. We look to Christ. Redemption is by the blood of a substitute. In Moses' day, it was the Lamb. You and I look to Christ. Fourth point is that redemption is a powerful delivery. In the case of the Israelites, it was the Red Sea. For you and I today, it's the resurrection of Christ. The resurrection of Christ. The picture of the Red Sea is purely a picture of Christ's deliverance from the world. That's redemption for you and I. That's 4 points. You can fill out the rest of the sermon yourself. Now, some people, I'm going to give one concluding thought and then we're all done. Some people have tried to explain this away as a natural phenomenon, that this was just something that Moses took advantage of, and he could see the forecast, he could forecast the weather, and he knew what was going to happen. He knew that there'd be a powerful east wind and that they'd use that to cover themselves as they walked through a swamp. The Bible makes it clear that this event had a clear starting point and a clear stopping point, which coincided with Moses' raising of his hands. This was clearly a controlled situation, not a freak of nature. God was intervening in nature just as he chose, in a way he chose, at a time he chose. Understand another thing. This is not a small band of people that we're talking about here. This is around 2 million at least, and they are being pursued by the largest military on earth at this time. It will not be paralleled until the Babylonian Empire, another 1,500 years later. This is a huge army. So let's put it into modern perspective. Let's imagine that you're going home and you're going to turn on the primetime news tonight or tomorrow, for instance. Imagine that you hear about the largest military force on earth today completely annihilated and a nation held hostage by that nation being extracted and becoming another national entity at the same time. That is earth-shattering, groundbreaking news. There would be nothing else to talk about. You wouldn't worry about what the royal family is wearing today anymore because this is so important. A nation forged in one day, and one nation's military might completely destroyed and the head of state killed. Try to put that into perspective. That is the news we're talking about here with the delivery through the Red Sea. Brother Fisher, could I call on you to close us in a word of prayer? Thank you.